1-800-333-0850. Thank you.
This is Focus 580, our telephone talk program for the morning. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you here with us now for hour number two of the show. Producers Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, Jason Croft is at the controls this morning. In this part of Focus, we'll be talking about the mechanisms that we use when we cast votes. We considered the right to vote one of our most important American institutions. Yet, our guest for this part of Focus 580, Spencer Overton, professor at George Washington Law School, he says that right is endangered and argues that both Democrats and Republicans manipulate a complex web of election regulations to control who votes and how votes are counted, rather than the American voters selecting politicians. All too often, it is the politicians, essentially, who select the voters. This morning in this hour, we'll talk about what's wrong and how the system might be reformed, and it is the subject of a book that our guest has authored. The title is Stealing Democracy, the subtitle The New Politics of Voter Suppression. It is published by W.W. Norton. As I mentioned, Spencer Overton is professor at George Washington University Law School. He served on the Jimmy Carter James Baker Commission on Federal Election Reform and currently sits on the boards of a number of organizations, including Common Cause and the Center for Responsive Politics. He's taught at University of California, Davis, served as the Charles Hamilton Houston Fellow at Harvard Law School, and in 2006 was recognized as one of 10 emerging scholars in America by Diverse Issues in Higher Education magazine. If you're interested, of course, you can seek out the book. It should be out in the bookstores now. And questions from people who are listening, they are also welcome. All we ask is people just try to be brief so that we can accommodate as many callers as possible. We'd like to get in as many people as would like to call in on the show. And you're certainly welcome in the conversation. 333-9455. That's the Champaign-Urbana number here where we are. We do also have a toll-free line. That means if it would be a long-distance call, use that number, and that is 800-222-9455. Again, here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. Professor Overton, hello.
David, how are you?
I'm fine, thanks. And yourself?
I'm great.
Well, I appreciate you giving us some of your time today. I think that it is true that political parties in this country have long realized that there are two ways that you can go about winning elections. One, you can make sure your voters turn out. The other is you can do what you can to blunt your opponents and either make it difficult for the other guy's voters to get to the polls or to do what you can to make sure that those votes just aren't counted, that they don't count. So this is not particularly new. Do you think, however, that the matter of voter suppression is somehow now worse than it has been in the past, or a bigger problem than in the past?
Right, David, you're absolutely right. It's not new. We've certainly seen this since the beginning of the Republic. We certainly saw it following the Civil War when white Democrats tried to exclude African-American Republicans from voting by using literacy tests and poll taxes and other devices. The disturbing thing, David, though, is that it's happening now. We talk a great game about exporting democracy in this country, but in fact the people are not in control. Both Democrats and Republicans use tools like redistricting and a variety of barriers to voting to determine who votes and whose vote counts. And some things are different, David. Politicians have computer technology that allows them to identify voters and figure out which voters will cast ballots against them, which voters will cast ballots for them, and they can use that technology to, in a much more sophisticated way, redraw district lines to ensure that they're reelected and maintain their power. They're able to use that technology to target voters in terms of challenging their qualifications, and so maybe they don't challenge their own voters, their supporters' qualifications, but maybe they challenge their opponents' qualifications, of the voters who will support their opponent or are likely to. So there is a new level and a new element to voter suppression today.
Let's talk about some of these things that you examine in the book. When you look at a couple of the big ways that parties try to stack the deck in their favor. You touched on one of them, and that is gerrymandering.
Right.
Give us an example.
Okay, let's say I'm a Democrat, Democratic legislator, David, and I won my last election just narrowly with 51% of the vote, and that was just too close for me. And as a result, I redraw the district lines to enhance the number of Democrats in my district, and I remove some Republican precincts from my district. And so in the next election, I win in a landslide with 70% of the votes. And I win not because I'm more responsive to the needs of my constituents, but simply because I've shuffled the voters. Now, this happens on a widespread scale across the country, and both Democrats and Republicans do it. In the 2004 elections, David, Congress had only a 40% approval rating, and yet 98% of incumbents won. Why? Because of the way these districts are drawn. And it's a problem across the country. 36 states basically have situations where politicians draw the lines, and in many other states, their minions and political operatives draw the lines for them. And so we've got a situation where the fox is guarding the hen house, an inherent notion of conflict of interest.
Now, this isn't there supposed to be some sort of judicial oversight of the way districts are drawn to prevent essentially districts being drawn in order to disenfranchise certain blocks of voters?
Well, David, we do have some protections. There's a one-person, one-vote protection that was basically brought into existence in the 1960s, where all the districts have to be about the same population. And that's why we have redistricting after the census, generally, at the beginning of the decade, every decade. Also, the Voting Rights Act and some other provisions protect and ensure that politicians don't unnecessarily exclude minority voters. So those are important protections, but we really do need to protect the voting rights of all Americans. And unfortunately, there hasn't been effective judicial protection of the rights of all voters. If we just look at the recent Texas case that the Supreme Court heard, and in that case, Republicans engaged in redistricting to pick up power in the middle of the decade. And the Supreme Court decided not to get involved. They decided not to invalidate that unprecedented plan that was done largely for partisan purposes. And the problem with the Supreme Court's decision is that it opens the floodgates for political payback by Democrats in states like New Mexico, Louisiana, and also Illinois, right, where Democrats control the process. Also, if your poll numbers are down, let's say you're a Dem in a place like Illinois and you control the state legislature and your poll numbers are down just before the election, why not just redraw the districts in order to help ensure that your party won't lose power? So there are real problems here with the Supreme Court's decision. It really is a slippery slope.
Yeah, this was the case that was orchestrated by Tom DeLay.
That's definitely.
And as you point out, got a lot of attention, went all the way to the Supreme Court. And also, as you point out, I think a lot of people were watching this to see what would happen, because parties, not just in other places where Republicans might want to do this, but also in other places where Democrats might want to do this, they were looking to see, now, did the Republicans in Texas prevail? They did. So then that may mean that it's open season on redistricting, maybe not whenever you want, but certainly this long practice of doing it in conjunction with the census is now just going to go by the wayside.
I think that's right. And the problem here is, again, it's not a problem in terms of Republicans doing it and Democrats doing it. And some people say, well, you know, isn't it okay if both Republicans and Democrats can do it? Won't it even itself out? The problem with that is it really focuses on the political elites, like democracy is just a battle between the savviness of the political elites, and it's not about voters. And what we need to do is really focus more on voters and empowering voter choice, as opposed to voters simply being pawns to be shuffled around by politicians. Mm.
So you point in this, particularly in this beginning section of the book, to a couple of problems. One is this business of who it is that gets to draw districts and how they are drawn. The other kind of problem that you point to is the fact that the officials within states, the officials who oversee elections, are elected partisans and that they are much too much in the position to influence how elections are run. And then if there's some sort of problem, let's reference, for example, the state of Florida in the year 2000. If there's some kind of problem, then the person who is ultimately going to rule one way or another is not someone who is an objective party with no kind of allegiance there to consider.
That's right, David. You remember in 2000, Catherine Hare, she was chair of the Bush-Cheney campaign, and she was also the Secretary of State who was responsible for administering elections. And in 2004, people have heard about Ken Blackwell, who was chair of the Bush-Cheney campaign in Ohio. And it's, again, not just a Republican problem. That same issue occurs when Democrats are secretaries of states. And we've got, in 33 states, we've got elected partisans who are in charge of administering elections. And in many more, we have appointed partisans who administer elections. And so we've got essentially the umpire who is on one team who makes decisions. And I'll tell you, even when the decisions are made in good faith, there's always suspicion that was this done as a result of a partisan interest. When Ken Blackwell, for example, announces a rule out of the blue that registrations will be rejected unless the registration card is printed on 80-pound paper, and a number of registrations are thrown out as a result, you know, people wonder, is this an honest and fair decision, or is this just, you know, Ken Blackwell trying to drive down voter participation? In most countries around the world, we have independent commissions that redraw districts, and we also have independent commissions that administer elections. Even in Iraq, for example, there's an independent commission that administers elections. So in Iraq, the country, the democracy that we set up, they are in line with international norms. Unfortunately, in the United States, we are not.
I want to ask one more question, and then I have a caller here. I want to tell that person I'm not going to make them wait forever. Just one sort of bottom line question here. What you're arguing for is when it comes to drawing districts and in regulating how elections are run, you're arguing for taking politics out of the process, which seems to be a very difficult thing to achieve.
I think that that's right, but I think it's not necessarily taking politics out of the process completely. I think it is taking out the conflict of interest. So, for example, if we used a jury as an analogy, certainly on a jury you have some people who sympathize with the defense and some people who sympathize with the prosecution, but they don't work for the prosecution. They don't work for the defense, right? And so I think it's impossible to get a perfectly objective jury, but I think our current jury system is much better than a jury system in which basically the prosecution gets to appoint all the jurors that, you know, come from the prosecution's office, or the defense counsel basically gets its paralegals and lawyers to go in and sit on the jury. So it's a notion of how do we remove this conflict of interest. I don't know that we want to be completely blind here in terms of politics. I do think it's important to represent all elements of a state and of our country. And so we wouldn't want to exclude conservatives or exclude liberals, which we might end up doing if we went into this completely blind to the politics that are there. So my biggest concern here, David, is the conflict of interest that exists and the self-serving nature of politicians as opposed to being aware of the need to ensure that different views are at the table.
Our guest this morning, Spencer Overton, is law professor at George Washington University, and he specializes in issues involving voting rights. He's often interviewed and quoted in the media talking about these issues. He's authored a new book that examines the issue. The title is Stealing Democracy, The New Politics of Voter Suppression, and it is published by W.W. Norton. And we have a caller here who's been patient, and we'll get right to them on our line number one. Hello.
Yes, this is very interesting, and I think I read a New York Times editorial right after the delay decision that said the Supreme Court had put its stamp of approval on non-competitive congressional district races, I guess, which occurs through this partisan gerrymandering. And, of course, I think the turnover in our Congress probably is less than the turnover in the Politburo in the Soviet Union.
Mm-hmm.
Because of the partisan gerrymandering. So I guess that is a problem with this. I just think the court is viewing this as a political ticket that belongs in the political process, and to the victor goes the spoils, for better or for worse. My question is, in this vein, what are your feelings about minority-majority race gerrymandering, where African Americans or Latino Americans have a district that assures or enhances the chance that a person of that ethnic persuasion will be elected to a seat in the Congress?
Mm-hmm.
Is that benign gerrymandering, or is that something you find as a threat to our democracy?
Right. Let me deal with the first point in terms of the political thicket, and I appreciate the arguments by people who say, well, you know, we don't want courts making political judgments, and they might have had they overruled this Texas redistricting. My concern is that was the argument that was made in the one-person, one-vote case, and fortunately, that argument didn't win out, and fortunately, we have a constitutional principle of one-person, one-vote right now as a result of courts getting involved in protecting average voters from politicians. The concern here is when there is a political failure, because of this self-interest, it's important for courts to get involved and to break this deadlock. Certainly the court felt, and I don't know if I agree with its opinion, but it felt like it could get involved with campaign finance decisions and strike down particular laws, even though, again, it could have been termed as getting into the political thicket. So I think it's important to protect individual voters, just as in the campaign finance cases, the court felt as though it was protecting contributors, although I think that is a question there. Now, in terms of minority districts, I certainly do think that they do serve an important role. And the reason I think they do is that if we look at minority districts, only about 6% of the districts in the country are majority African-American, let's say, even though the population is about 12% African-American of our country. And those districts that are majority-minority or minority African-American or minority Latino are generally much more integrated than other districts. So in other words, many other districts might be 80 or 90% white, whereas these districts are generally only 50 or 51 or 52% African-American or Latino. And so often the elected official really does have to work with people from different communities. So these areas and these districts are often much more integrated than other districts. Now, again, I'm not necessarily for, hey, let's go out of our way to racially gerrymander and pack all of the blacks in one district so they've got a district that's 95% African-American in order to just, you know, put them in some kind of, you know, segregated ghetto here or Latinos. I think that's a problem. I think to a certain extent that happened in Texas, and the court struck down that part of the redistricting plan when the legislators took out 100,000 Latinos and put them in another district. So there is a concern with that, but I do think it's important that we hear the voices of all Americans, and that we don't just relegate some folks and say, hey, you all aren't responsible. You know, you have to be paired here with a district that's 80% white because we don't trust you and we don't trust your vision or the person that you're going to elect.
Thank you, sir.
All right. Thank you for the call. And once again, questions are welcome here on the program, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Our guest, Spencer Overton, is professor of law at George Washington University Law School. Let's talk about another set of issues. And as you point out in the book, decisions, local officials have a lot of control over how elections are carried out, and things like how people register and how they go about voting, where the polling places are, how many voting machines there are, where you put your voting machines, and that makes it very difficult. Well, it's impossible to have any kind of national standard, and maybe there shouldn't be. But then I suppose then the other side of the question is, well, yes, maybe there should be. Maybe somehow the federal government should be involved in having some kind of consistency of rules and how it is from one place to the next, how its elections are run.
Yeah, David, you're right. Your right to vote depends on where you live. We've got 4,600 different election systems in this country. All of them have different rules. We've got massive inequality with regard to the funding of elections as well. And so, for example, in Columbus, Ohio, election officials knew they needed 5,000 voting machines, but they decided to make do with only 3,000. And they moved some machines out of urban areas and into suburban areas. As a result, Tanya Thivner, she voted in Columbus. She waited 4 hours in line to vote. Her mother voted in a suburb, and her mother waited only 15 minutes to cast a ballot. David, you know, voters are treated like cattle. Dorothy Turner also voted in Ohio. She's an 80-year-old woman. She had to wait in line, stand in line without a chair for 2.5 hours. No one offered her a chair. She said that her back hurt, but that she stood in line because she thought it might be the last time she had an opportunity to vote. David, Starbucks and McDonald's, they don't make people wait in 2.5 hour lines or 4 hour lines. They'd go out of business if they did that. Voting is at least as important as a quarter pounder or as a Frappuccino. We can really do better. We really should. I think that federal guidelines are an important part of it. I also think that federal funding to ensure that we have a minimum base funding and ensure there are enough machines so that we don't have four-hour lines, I think that's an important component. But I also think that it's important that we reserve a role for local administrators and local ideas so that we can have innovation. For example, in Wisconsin and in Minnesota, there is Election Day registration. People can go to the polls and they can register on Election Day. If we had one rigid federal system, all the rules completely the same, there's a question as to whether or not we would have that kind of innovation. So I do believe in the importance of local involvement and local control. My concern, though, is that you may have some boss hog type abuses or just some incompetence, as we saw with the Palm Beach butterfly ballot in Florida in 2000, some real incompetence by local administrators. Voters shouldn't be lab rats. We do need some federal checks to protect the right to vote and also federal funding.
Let me just pick up there real quick on that point, because that last point, because running elections, holding elections, it is expensive. To what extent do you think that that is a genuine problem? That is, various places around the country simply don't have the money, they don't have the financial resources to make sure that access is really there for everybody.
Right. I think it's a major problem. I mean, in Wyoming, they spend about $2 per voter, and in California, they spend about twice as much per voter. And it's not just a problem from state to state. It's a problem within the state. Much like schools and crime as well, because elections are often funded by local property taxes and local taxes. And the problem is even worse with regard to elections, because people move to particular communities because of the schools and because of safe streets. And so often communities are willing to invest money in those projects because they know that property values are tied to safety and to good schools. Unfortunately, money is sometimes taken away from elections because, you know, administrators know that, you know, people aren't going to move because of a long line at the voting polls, whereas they may move because the schools aren't very good. And as a result, sometimes they nickel and dime elections. So I do think it's a significant problem. When we talk about spending $2 per vote in a place like Wyoming, in Mexico they spend about $9 or $10 per vote there, and they've got a very sophisticated system there to protect voting rights, as well as in Canada and in some other places. So there is a need for more and better funding so that we can at least have a minimum baseline of opportunity to cast a ballot. Mm.
We're at our midpoint here. We have some other callers we'll get to in just a moment. I do just want to update you on the weather here, just to remind you that there is the possibility here in our part of the state of some severe weather today. And in fact, earlier this morning, the Storm Prediction Center issued a severe thunderstorm watch, and that's the one that means that conditions are favorable for storms in and around the watch area. This includes parts of eastern Missouri and southern Illinois, and will be in effect until 4 o'clock Central Daylight Time this afternoon. There's possibility of some hail, thunderstorm winds, dangerous lightning. It's all possible in that area. And in our immediate AM 580 severe weather coverage area, these counties are included: Christian, Clark, Cumberland, and Shelby. So again, that's a severe thunderstorm watch for parts of eastern Missouri and southern Illinois until 4 o'clock this afternoon. And do keep in mind that the severe weather is a possibility, and we will try to keep you up to date on what's happening with the weather. We'll have our next comprehensive look at the weather as part of the afternoon magazine this afternoon. Also, because it's Friday, an opportunity to call in and get a forecast on some place that you might be traveling. Now, we will get back to folks who are listening who would like to call in, and oh, maybe just real quick, I'll introduce again our guest, Spencer Overton. He's a professor at the George Washington University Law School. His book is Stealing Democracy, The New Politics of Voter Suppression, published by W.W. Norton, and it's out now. Our next caller is in Charleston. We'll go there on our line four. Hello.
Yes, thank you very much. I have to first address the humor of your guest, Boss Hog and Lab Rats. I think that is so appropriate. But anyway, my question for him is, well, his research and understanding of the lack, or the people who do not vote, who comprise, I think, 50% or more of eligible voters who do not vote. And have you addressed that question already?
Okay, thank you very much for the question. I think it is a significant problem in terms of the lack of voter participation we have. You know, the United States is in the bottom 19% of all democracies in the world in terms of voter turnout. And let me also note, I do think voting is very important, and I don't want to discourage people from voting. Politicians would love it if even fewer people voted. So we certainly don't want to buy into that trap. We want people to get out, not be discouraged by this. If you're not registered, you can register to vote online at stealingdemocracy.com. Also, if you are registered but you've moved and you need to update your registration, you can do that at stealingdemocracy.com as well. Now, I think some people don't vote because they make a very calculated decision of, hey, this really doesn't matter. These districts are set up. There's no reason these people aren't responsive to me. These politicians aren't responsive to me. There are people who are not engaged. And I understand that, but I really do think that it's important for us to be engaged. It also comes down to the rules. In places like Mexico, the government actually goes out and affirmatively registers people, much as we go out and have census takers who actually go out and affirmatively count people in terms of the census. And as a result, the registration rate in Mexico is about 94%, whereas we are somewhere in the 70s here in the United States in terms of percentage of people registered to vote. So part of it comes down to the rules and making voting accessible. You know, when the thought here is that in Ohio, there are about 175,000 people who didn't vote as a result of the long lines and being discouraged by the 3- and 4-hour lines. And so we really do need to do what we can to make voting as easy and as accessible as possible.
Yes. Well, if I can say one last thing, I am an old fellow, and I only began to vote after I was age 40.
Mm-hmm.
And my take on it was that people are not deceived. You know, whenever you would go down to have a gourmet meal, and then they brought you Rice Krispies, I don't think your attention would be very well kept. And that's what I'm saying, that people are smart, whether you're literate or illiterate or interested or uninterested. The results are what always calculate, or in my opinion, calculates what people do. Mm-hmm. If your vote is meaningless and you take it as such, especially in national elections, local elections are somewhat different, but the paradigm remains the same. And when people are discouraged and are smart enough to understand what is going on and their response to it, and that's been my take over time of why people do not vote. You know, you're going to tell me this and thus and so is going to happen, and history bears out otherwise. So in any case, I've a good program, David, and thank you very much, and you too, for the guest.
All right, well,
bye-bye.
Thanks for the call.
Thank you.
Let's continue. We'll talk next with someone here on a cell phone. This is our line one. Hello.
Yeah, I think your point about the long lines is kind of an important one, because one of the things I've tend to keep out of too much political debate, because I find that it seems to get in the way of getting my work done. But one of the things I often hear from conservative friends is voting should be hard, or you know, that kind of argument. You know, you should actually have to want to do it, and this would be the argument that is often made in terms of you know basically claiming this sort of the responsible voter theory,
right,
thing. And I really think if you had say suburban neighborhoods where which were quite Republican, which, you know, say suburbs around Atlanta or something like that, let's just pick an example, and they had four-hour lines, they would be screaming bloody murder.
Mm-hmm.
My general principle for whenever I deal with these things is whenever I talk to people is, if you flopped all the partisan labels and something happened, would you be okay with it? And I don't think in the case of four-hour-plus lines for voting, people would be okay with that. So it seems to me that, you know, one of the things conservatives often accuse people on the left, and I'm not really sure I would call myself one of those people, but it's one of the things of, you know, elitism. Well, the voting should be hard is definitely an elitist position. No, I really support your point that this is a problem of both parties. They both would like it, and honestly, unless there's some neutral observers overseeing the situation, it's not going to stop. Well, I'll hang up and listen. Thanks.
All right, thanks for the call.
Thanks for the call, and remember what we're talking about here, which is changing voting so that we prevent bureaucracy, so that we enhance efficiency, and so that we allow individual citizens to exercise liberty without unnecessary kind of government bureaucracy that makes the exercise of that liberty hard. And those are very important values. Now, I do understand the argument. Some people say, well, you know, individual responsibility is key. People should take it upon themselves to learn English to vote or to get a photo ID, or people should be responsible enough to not commit a crime, and therefore we can just disenfranchise those people for life even after they've completed a sentence in prison. We can just disenfranchise them for life. So I've heard that, this kind of individual responsibility piece. The problem with that, though, is that the objective of voting is to ascertain the will of all citizens, not just some. Lincoln talked about government of, by, and for the people, you know, the man who is from Illinois. And it really does become a slippery slope, because at first we talk about, well, let's exclude all people who've committed a felony for life, even after they've completed their time, or let's exclude everybody who doesn't have a photo ID, they're not responsible, or let's exclude those people who don't feel comfortable voting in English here because, you know, they're citizens, but they need to learn English to vote. But then we get to, there's a next step, slippery slope, in terms of poll taxes. Hey, let's have folks pay poll taxes so we can have more money for elections, or let's get people to take literacy tests so that we can have an educated electorate that's not making bad and poorly informed decisions. And pretty soon we're talking about stereotypes with women being more emotional and, you know, maybe they shouldn't be able to cast their vote. You know, it's just a slippery slope, and the best thing is for all citizens to cast a ballot and to vote and to prevent manipulation of politicians by targeting particular demographic groups and excluding those people in order to enhance their own chances. Again, objective of voting, ascertain the will of all citizens, and we really do. We're all hurt when even someone else is excluded, and we're all hurt because we're not having that democratic dialogue and that real exchange where everyone is a part of this social compact and we're hearing from everyone.
But do you think that the parties have indeed made deliberate efforts to target demographic groups, prevent specific blocks of voters, and to be very specific, talking about African American, Latino, and Asian voters, from being able to cast their votes?
I think that the answer is yes. I mean, if you were to look, I mean, part of sometimes it's a candidate, sometimes it's a party. If we were to look, for example, in Alabama recently, just in the town where Forrest Gump was from, the movie Forrest Gump was set, there was a white candidate, and he challenged Asian American voters when they came to the polls just in 2004, and not surprisingly, he was running against an Asian American candidate, and he assumed that those voters would cast ballots for that candidate. If you look, for example, in Killmichael, Mississippi, there the town just in 2001 had grown to 52% African American, and the all-white town council canceled the election just 3 weeks before Election Day because some African American challengers were running against them. And in terms of parties, I think it is also an issue. In Ohio, the Republican Party targeted African-American precincts to challenge the qualifications of voters. Now, they would say those are the precincts that were the heaviest in terms of Democrats, and so they would say that it was a party thing and not a race thing. The problem is that white Democrats following the Civil War targeted black Republicans, not just because they were black, but because they voted Republican and they wanted to maintain their own power. So really, race and politics is intertwined. It's very difficult to separate them. And we really should just say, you know, suppressing votes and voters is out of bounds. I think that my friend Susan Molinari, who was on the Carter Baker Commission with me, would cite examples of military voters overseas being excluded, or their ballots being delayed in terms of a method of suppressing Republican votes. So I think we see all types of voters. Certainly, race is sometimes used as a proxy for political affiliation. There are some other things like military service and other things that may be used as proxies for political affiliation. And I'll tell you this, it's all wrong.
We have another caller here. Let's get to them, and that's someone listening over in Indiana, line 3. Hello.
Hello. Thank you for being extremely articulate. It's refreshing. I hope some Democrats are listening to you, or you may have ways to advise them, but certainly been interesting. And that last thing about, I didn't even thought about the military votes, but I've been in those situations where certain rules and regulations were twisted or changed at the last moment that kept out many black voters down in North Carolina when I was in school down there. I'd like to give you the opportunity to sketch out what you think should be done in terms of this situation. I know you've already given a number of facts and data, but I thought maybe there was a way you were going to tie it all together. Thanks a lot.
Okay.
Thanks so much for the call. I think that we really need to do a couple things. Average Americans as individuals, I think we need to really get out and vote. Like I said, if you're not registered to vote, you can do so at stealingdemocracy.com. That's the first step, but that's not enough. We also need to work the polls and work in watchdog groups like the League of Women Voters, Common Cause, election protection groups. We've got to preserve democracy in our own neighborhood. So, you know, we can't wait around for politicians or government to change things. We've got to get involved and work to change things ourselves. Now, there's some structural things we need to do. I think we need to stop manipulation by renewing the Voting Rights Act, and I think that's going to happen. That's received bipartisan support. President Bush has been a strong supporter of renewal of the Voting Rights Act, and it just passed in the Senate 98-0 yesterday. We also need to audit election offices and private vendors that supply these voting machines as well. That is important. We need real procedures. We audit big companies in order to protect shareholders. There's no reason that we shouldn't audit these machine companies and also election administrators to ensure the integrity of the process. So one part of it is stopping manipulation by politicians. The other part of it is opening up access to all voters through things like Election Day registration. I think that we need to restore voting rights to people who have completed their sentence and served their time completely in states like Florida, Virginia, and Kentucky, where that's currently not the case. I do think that translated election materials are good things that actually unite Americans and prevent politicians from scapegoating particular communities. And in light of the fact that 70% of the Americans who use translated election materials are born in the United States, I don't look at it as an immigration issue. I also think we need federal funds to ensure that we have, for example, enough voting machines so we don't have four-hour lines. So those two big things, stopping manipulation by politicians and opening up access, I think those are the two things we need to focus on.
Hmm. We are talking here this morning with Spencer Overton. He is professor of law at George Washington University Law School, and his special area of emphasis is election law. And he is the author of Stealing Democracy, The New Politics of Voter Suppression. It's published by W.W. Norton. We certainly have time for other questions. 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. I mentioned that you were involved with this commission, the Carter-Baker Commission, and that one of the places that you parted company with the other members of the commission had to do with its recommendation that there be photo IDs
right.
for voters, and this is something that you're really concerned about,
right?
And we can talk about that, but I guess that I'm interested in the question of voter fraud and the fact that it seems that when we talk about it, it seems to sort of presuppose this idea that there is a lot of voter fraud but committed by individuals, either, I don't know, voting if they're not qualified to, or if they're not registered, or voting in places they're not registered, or I'm not exactly sure what the problem is. Is there evidence, in fact, that there is a lot of that kind of voter fraud going on?
No, you make a good point. There's not evidence, or the evidence that exists, rather, suggests that there's not very much. And let's just talk about that for a second, David. I think it does really, on first glance, seem reasonable to say, hey, you need a photo ID to vote. We have a photo ID to get on an airplane. And at first glance, it certainly does sound reasonable. The problem, David, is that there are 20 million Americans who are voting age who don't have a photo ID. Now, that's more people than in Delaware, New Mexico, and 14 other states. Now, when you compare that to the amount of fraud, it really outweighs the fraud that's out there. So, for example, there was a statewide study done in Ohio, and they found only 4 fraudulent ballots in all the counties, only 4 fraudulent ballots out of 9 million ballots cast. And so my concern here is that we might, by having a photo ID requirement, we might exclude over 1,000 legitimate voters for every 1 fraudulent vote. I'm afraid that we are essentially throwing the baby out because the baby has 1 drop of bathwater on the baby's arm. I think that we need tools that deal with that bathwater. I don't think we should ignore that bathwater, but we need tools that deal with that bathwater and not the baby. So, for example, I'm in favor of better voter registration lists, where we clean up the list. I'm fine with, for example, if we were to put together a list of all the citizens in the United States and compared that list to a voter registration list to ensure that people who are on the rolls as registered voters are citizens. And I think that that makes perfect sense. People also say, well, you know, we do have a photo ID requirement to get on an airplane, you know, and I think it's apples and oranges. For example, I think we should exclude 1,000 legitimate flyers who don't have their photo ID if that means we're going to stop the one flyer who's the terrorist who could blow up the plane. That makes perfect sense. But in terms of stopping 1,000 legitimate voters in order to block the off chance that we'll block and prevent one fraudulent vote, I think the problem is that, you know, takes us farther away from the objective of democracy, which is ascertaining the will of all citizens. I'm all for a photo ID if there's significant fraud out there and the amount of fraud that's out there is going to outweigh the amount of legitimate voters that would be excluded by a photo ID. So for me, I'm really driven by empirical evidence and facts, and I think that the facts right now suggest that a photo ID would exclude many more legitimate voters than fraudulent voters. In fact, maybe 1,000 times more. But I could be convinced otherwise if we had better data that showed that there was more fraud out there. Again, I think we need to focus on the facts rather than an individual story here or there. You know, I really am about the evidence, us following the evidence, rather than anecdotal stories of and implementing a policy that might do a lot more harm than good.
Mm-hmm. You, in the book, and I'm sure elsewhere, you have, as you did a couple of moments ago, spoken about the importance of extending, renewing the Voting Rights Act.
Mm-hmm.
And this apparently will happen, at least, as you said, it passed the Senate 98-0. Why those two senators didn't vote, I don't know, but there were two that didn't vote. It previously had passed the House 390-33, so there actually were some opponents, and I believe that mostly these were Southern Republican members of Congress. And the president has said that he would sign it,
and
said that he thought it was very important, so this would extend it for 25 years. Is there somehow any doubt in your mind that, even though now the Congress has approved it and the president has said that he will sign it, that somehow there's any problem with having not only having it signed into law, but then having it carried out?
Well, you know, just kind of first of all, if this thing is not renewed, or if for some reason the Supreme Court strikes parts of it down, we're really in danger of losing hundreds, if not thousands, of African American, Latino, and Asian American officials, and so we really do need it. And why we need it? Because we still have problems. In Prairie View, Texas, for example, in 2004, the district attorney down there threatened to arrest students at a historically black college for voting. And the county board down there reduced the polling hours at the poll closest to the historically black college from 17 hours down to 6 hours. The Republican Attorney General of Texas stepped in and said, you know, this is wrong. This is a problem. Students should be able to vote where they attend school and where they live to attend school. You're wrong, district attorney, and you're wrong, county board, for reducing these poll hours. And unfortunately, that was stopped, and that was stopped by the Voting Rights Act. It stopped this racial manipulation by requiring that these states and areas show that their election changes are not discriminatory. It prevents discriminatory election rules before they're on the books and prevents costly lawsuits. It's a perfect example of the fact that an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. Bilingual ballots were also a part of that. And as I mentioned, I think translated election materials are needed for the same reason literacy tests are illegal. We want all citizens to have a say. Literacy and English are very good and important skills, but we shouldn't dehumanize citizens by excluding them from our democracy simply because their language skills are not as strong. So I think that we've got good bipartisan support from both sides of the aisle. Both Republicans and Democrats recognize the importance of the Voting Rights Act. And so I'm confident that it will pass. And I'm hopeful that the Supreme Court, if there is a legal challenge, will uphold the Voting Rights Act. Mm-hmm.
Is there some particular point there that you where you have the sense that there's a possibility that there might be a challenge?
I do think, in fact, one of the opponents of the House of Representatives, he said that he was unable to get 218 votes in the House of Representatives, but he only needed 5 votes on the Supreme Court. So I do think that some of the political opponents of the Voting Rights Act, and as you mentioned, many of the opponents are from states that are covered by this particular part of the Voting Rights Act, and many of these opponents don't receive many votes from communities of color. And so the concern and problem is that they actually benefit when they politically benefit when African American or Latino voter turnout is not significant or large. And so I do think that there may be a challenge there, but I'm hopeful that the U.S. Supreme Court will uphold the Voting Rights Act as it has in the past.
Well, I think we will have to stop here because we've come pretty much to the end of the time. I want to again mention for people who are interested in exploring this territory, the book, Stealing Democracy, The New Politics of Voter Suppression. That's the subtitle. It's published by W.W. Norton. There is a website for the book if you're interested in a little bit more about the issues about our guest. And as he mentioned, that there is here, if you click on, go to the website and click on Get Involved, it will have a place here for you to update your voter's registration if you want to do that. You can do that through the website. And there's other information here on the issue as well. And that's www.stealingdemocracy.com. Otherwise, the book is, I'm sure, available in bookstores. Our guest, Spencer Overton, professor of law at George Washington University Law School. And Professor Overton, thank you very much.
David, thank you so much.
This program, Focus 580, made possible in part by a grant from Bodywork Associates, offering licensed massage therapy to Champaign-Urbana since 1982. Bodywork Associates has opened a new office inside the Oasis Center in the Illini Union. And that's about it for us here on Focus. Just before we go, a quick mention that on Monday, we will be doing a program that we had scheduled, actually, I think, for a couple of weeks ago, and we weren't able to hook up with our guest at the last moment, but we will be doing it again. Hopefully this time things will go smoothly. We'll be talking with Jeanette Tamayo, and we'll be talking about a very large and detailed recent report that has come out about gang activity in the Chicago area, what we know about the gangs and how they operate. They've put out this book. It's entitled The Gang Book. It's something that they really put together for people in law enforcement, but it has a lot of interesting information in it. So we'll be talking about that in the first part of the show. And then hour number two, our bi-monthly, every other monthly program on women's health, Dr. Suzanne Troopin will be here. She is an obstetrician and a gynecologist, and we'll talk about that subject as well. We're here weekday mornings from 10 until noon, 10 different topics every week, and we always welcome your questions and comments. And now we hope you will stay tuned because there's much more coming up as part of the Afternoon Magazine. And the host for the show, Celeste Quinn.
Thank you, David. Coming up today in the 1 o'clock hour of the Afternoon Magazine, we will talk with molecular biologist Lee Silver. We'll talk with him about his latest book, Challenging Nature, The Clash of Science and Spirituality at the New Frontiers of Life. Let's turn our attention now to commodity prices.